everyone is a star child, made of stardust and the infinite potential of the universe. This extraordinary, fearless something in each of us clamors for freedom from the bonds of fear, conformity, and an ordinary life. Welcome to Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot, where practical tools and solutions from the intersection of mind-body medicine, science, and spiritual well-being awaken and empower you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. We tell our stories in order to share who we are, our hopes, our dreams, our triumphs, our tragedies, and to share our humanity. But what happens when that narrative gets hijacked, gets turned upside down on its head, and we're made to be inferior, inadequate, not up to it, don't have what it takes, and frankly, not a part of this society? Joining me today to have this conversation is Dr. Obari Cartman. And welcome back to the show, Dr. Obari.
Thanks for having me.
So it is always a pleasure, and I know that this conversation is very much a part of the work that you do. And with this being Black mm-hmm. History Month, I know it actually got my attention because I know that you are actually doing a program talking about this very topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I thought it would be a wonderful idea, again, to talk about, you know, how do we reframe our narrative, our story, right? So that it's an empowering Black history narrative that fuels our mental health instead mm-hmm. of the pain and the struggles that we feel around what our history in this country has been and how that in that way we feel diminished and mm-hmm. like we don't have value, don't have meaning, don't have purpose. So how we reframe that narrative so we do see the beauty and the power and the brilliance of who we are as African-American people, you know, in our own humanity and who have a great deal to contribute.
For sure. Yeah. And I'll start with this, that the point is to be able to tell the complex truths about what has happened to us, about our history here in this country. And it's a complicated history. And, you know, there's lots of ebb and flow, up and down, lots of really rich dynamics. And so I don't advocate for romanticizing the story. It is not my intent to create folklore and mythology about who we are, nor is it my intention to negate the struggle or the ugly parts of our history. I still think with that in mind, there's still a way, that there's still a way to be able to have the complex, rich, honest discussions about who we are and tell the stories about our history in ways that make us still feel proud and whole and not deficient and not less than. And I think that there has to be intention. I think we have to deliberately craft stories and highlight aspects of those stories that we have an outcome for. Like, so it's not just to tell a story, just to tell a story, not just to be provocative, not just to regurgitate what we heard from our parents or from the schools, but to really think through what stories do we highlight? What is the frame, the perspective of that story? And what is the intended outcome of the receiver of that story? And if we think through those pieces, I think that we could really use Black History Month and Black History period as a way to elevate us. And if we don't, I think there's a danger in having our history or the telling of our history in particular ways bring us down and disconnect us from our ancestors who experienced those stories, who we might feel a sense of shame about if the story is just we keep losing over and over again, or embarrassment about if the story is just yes or no, sir, master. If the story is just a trauma, then it makes the listener, if we're talking about the young folk, right? It's easy to tune that out. Maybe even healthy. If the frame is just trauma over and over again, it might even be good for them to be like, okay, no, I got it. That's enough of that. But there's aspects of even the struggle that I think can be highlighted to make the listener feel good about themselves and be connected to us, and ways to also tell parts of the story and highlight other parts of the story that are often omitted about resilience, resistance, about liberation, about the power. So it's a power analysis for me. How do we tell a story where we focus on the power of Blackness and then have our listener hear a story and leave away feeling more powerful because they heard that story? I think that has to be very, very intentional.
So I absolutely love what you said. And I think that to focus on the empowerment, the power, the resilience of our history and of our people is absolutely the best thing for us to do, the healing thing for us to do, because obviously everybody's had some difficulty, some adversity, trauma, many of us. So again, as you well know, as a psychologist, there's the what happens to you, but there's how do you assign meaning to it that either is helpful to you or harmful to you. So for those folks, for those folks who may not.
Let me say something about that though. I think that people hear that and think that we're suggesting twist the story around and make it pretty, put bows on the thing that's ugly. And if it's gross, if it's ugly, if it's disgusting, then that is what it is. And we should tell the story in that way. And I think that people think that we're saying, ignore those parts or pretty it up. And that's not what I hear you saying. And certainly it's not what I'm saying. But I want to deal with that so we're clear about what we're saying around meaning making and the truth being a part of the same intention.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. I'm not saying put lipstick on a pig. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, just keeping it real. I'm saying that that whatever happened. Us forcibly removed from Africa and brought here against our will and enslaved as a people and turned into a commodity for generations, where chattel slavery here, and you have 400,000 enslaved people who were grown into 4 million enslaved people. Nowhere else did that happen. Where you also had is I tell folks, and it really got my attention, is in the remake of Roots. The overseer says, how do you make a slave? How do you get a slave? And he says, you can't buy a slave. You got to make a slave. And that involves the stripping of one's identity and culture and name. Your name is what I say it is. And if you use the name in the language that is of your history, your culture, your identity, then you get punished. So you strip a person of their name, their language, their music, their culture, their drums. And then you say, you are who I say you are. You do what I say you can do. And you strip them of their humanity in saying that you're inferior, you're 3/5 of a human. And so therefore I'm entitled to do to you whatever inhumane, barbaric behaviors that I want to do to you. So in that story, that's the story of what happened. What I'm saying is what affects me, because I remember having the same feeling and struggle, which was, You know, you hear the stories about, you know, our enslavement, and it's painful, right? But at some point I was like, you know what, I'm tired of feeling, you know, guilt or some shame about somebody else's behavior towards us. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean when you change the perspective. The perspective is, I don't have anything to feel guilty or shamed about. It was not my behavior towards me or our people. It was someone else's behavior. So that's what I mean in terms of reframing the story. There's nothing wrong with me that I have to feel guilty or ashamed of, because it was somebody else who mistreated us. It was somebody else who did those things to us. And by changing the perspective, my perspective of what happened, I change how I feel about me, and I change how I feel about, you know, my possibilities. So mm-hmm. before you go ahead and comment on that, I want, for those folks who have heard, you know, our conversation from season one, I want to remind those, for those folks who are not familiar, excuse me, with the amazing Dr. Obari Cartman, I want to share with them, you know, who you are. So Dr. Cartman is a father, son, brother, uncle, thinker, writer, therapist, photographer, drummer, and grassroots mental health advocate. He was the previous president of the Chicago Association of Black Psychologists, and he recently created a male's rite of passage curriculum called Manifest that is being implemented in juvenile detention centers, schools, and other community settings. As a consultant, Dr. Cartman facilitates trainings for adults and youths, facilitates those workshops about maintaining good mental health, critical analysis of hip hop and media, racial and cultural identity, developing authentic manhood and healthy relationships. Dr. Cartman is currently completing his second book about Black spirituality, and it's titled Black Spirituality, A Practical Application of Ancient Wisdom, which will be released this year. And also, I may add, of course, you are the recipient of several awards for the amazing level of service and wisdom and commitment to us as a community, and to us as a people, and to, you know, to uplift and empower and educate us, frankly, about you know, our own sacredness and unique wonderfulness. So, well, again, welcome back. So, to the show and having this conversation.
Thank you very, very much.
Oh, you are always welcome. So, we were talking about, you know, the story is the story, framing it in a way not so that it appears that we are saying that that we put lipstick on a pig, keeping mm-hmm. it real, mm-hmm. but in a way that I say fuels our mental health, right? That creates mm-hmm. Health in both our thinking, and so what I call mental wealth or transformative thinking, that creates those healthy, that positive self-worth mm-hmm. and possibility and potential, but also in doing so, my emotions, because those thoughts and emotions create chemicals that are released in the body. And over time, if those chemicals are pretty much the same and the same levels,
yeah,
depending upon what we think and feel, they either create health or they create illness. And so you were talking about a framework that involved three steps. So let's go ahead and get into that some more.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the description of slavery you just gave. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very common, clear analysis about what happened to us. But as you were talking, there were points that I wanted to come back to, even as we describe in the most simple ways what happened, like the story is a story, that's what happened. And I think that there are layers and dynamics in even the way we typically tell the story, similar to how you did, mm-hmm. that I just think that we could do a little bit of wrestling with to help us tell that story, the what happened, mm-hmm. in a way that leaves people with a really sophisticated understanding of it.
Nuance.
That leaves us feeling more powerful. So the whole point is power. My whole goal is to say Black History Month should be a moment when we leave the month having more people feel more powerful and more connected and more proud of being who we are than in January. Right. So that's my goal. So even so, the story you told.
Can I get you to clarify something? Because I know, you know, some folks have difficulty and feel uncomfortable with the word power. And I know how I use the word power. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, pretty sure I have a pretty good idea about how you use the word power. But so that folks are not left to misinterpret what you mean in by the use of the word power.
That's important.
What is it for? To do what?
So
let me
go back a little bit to my upbringing. Mm-hmm. I was raised in what you would consider to be African-centered, Afrocentric houses, communities, where we played drums, we celebrated Kwanzaas. I went to a private school where we were learning about Marcus Garvey. Sort of that thing that carried my parents picked my name out of a book of African names, and the whole time ever since then have been trying to instill in their family a sense that Africa has its own philosophy and worldview and cultural value system. And so I was raised in that community. And so the words I use are a reflection of the value system that comes out of that community, that perspective. And so from an American, a Western perspective, I do agree that the word power could be interpreted as power over or domination or aggression. But from an African-centered point of view, when we think about the self, we think about interdependence. When we think about the value systems that guide us, we think about communalism. We think about interdependence. We think about spirituality. We think about harmony versus competition. So there's a whole different way of being in the world that most people on the planet have, you know, indigenous roots that connect to a value system that speaks to harmony, collectivism, cooperation. And so there's a unique moment when a European ideology that focuses on hierarchies and domination and individualism and separation, those kind of things that are at the root, at the foundation of many of the societies that are now in power, that have a Eurocentric framework, that those things are a construction, a distortion of what it means to be human in ways that my work, my philosophy very much rejects and finds a different home in a different value system. And so when I say power, I don't mean domination. I don't mean power over. I don't mean hierarchies. I mean the ability to express a divine inspiration, a God-given gift, talent, vision, and instruction, and the ability to be able to manifest that, to be able to express that, is more about agency. It's more about even the planning and the execution of ideas happens in consideration of community. There's sort of a I am because we are philosophy. And so the power is in the relationships. The power is in the family, in the community. It's not an individual power over others. And there's a power in culture. There's a power in healing, a power in the medicines. There's a power in being able to take nothing and create something from that. There's ingenuity, there's creativity, there's power in being able to innovate. So those are the things that are powerful things to me. Just being able to express the purpose and the meaning that you're intended, that you were created for, and to be able to collaborate with to make sure that everyone has what they need and more, right? Abundance. So the idea of scarcity creates competition, but the idea that we are in an abundant world, an abundant universe, means that we can collaborate and could share, and that we are all more powerful together when we are expressing our individual God-given talents and passions. But when we come together to do that with intention, then there's a power beyond that that we can't even sort of even imagine, that it gets exercised, that has application, that shows up in ways that continues to evolve. And so power for me is that. Power for me is Black people being able to have a destiny and an intention on this planet that gets thwarted. There's opposition against that. And we're talking about slavery is one of those things, but you know, we're talking 2024 versions of enslavement and mass incarceration and systemic disinvestment of neighborhoods and distortion of information, that all is an attempt to hold the structural economic power in place and quell the innate, natural, divine power of the melanated people on this planet, the indigenous people, the descendants of the first peoples, that we have a power in our humility and our connection to the earth and to the divine, that those who have the physical structural power, and that's really just an illusion of being able to control and manipulate, that those people are afraid of the mm-hmm. power of the parents of the planet. So what we're talking about in terms of slavery and every institution since then
has tried to keep the power. I lost you there for a second. You said they're afraid of...
I don't know. I'm just talking. The expression of the power, us tapping into that power, yeah, because it would disrupt the social, economic, political order that they have fought and used so much violence to establish for themselves. And so slavery is a part of that. So when I think about slavery, it's a part of that. The thing that I struggle with in the story of slavery and how we tell it, chattel slavery, the transatlantic slave trade, African human trafficking form of slavery, is, you know, and I kind of grew up with this in my mind. I kind of grew up with like Europeans snuck into Africa in the middle of the night and kidnapped millions of Africans, right? And so when you grow up and you study it and you look at it, like that just cannot be true. It can't be. And I think that story of the Africans as victims of a sort of conniving, maniacal, powerful European, without being able to really wrestle with that, I think the questions that people have are, how were they able to do that? And that's the question that I developed as more as an adult. Like, I get what they did, and we tell a story about what they did to us, but like, what gave them the power to do that? What mm-hmm. made them? And without an explanation, you kind of just leave them as superior, right? The myth of white superiority gets maintained through the telling of a story where we are for generations victims of the advanced military might or the technological wisdom or even the maniacal ingenuity of a European still makes them more powerful than us if they were able to accomplish trafficking millions of people, turning them into even more millions of people, to the diaspora of this part of the world. So the part that I think that we're starting to wrestle with that is one of those complicated dynamics is the ways in which we participated. And I think that we can talk about that part of the story, talk about a European going to the continent of Africa, bargaining with the royalty, those in power, and making deals on behalf of what an African might have thought benefited them by exchanging bodies for fur, for bullets, for trinkets, right? So that part of the story is an uglier part of the story, and it makes us complicit in ways, at least as participants. And we say that we didn't know what we were, you know, selling us each other into. And there's also another analysis that talks about us putting a umbrella of African onto a continent of people that did not have that ideology, that they were just as different from each other as we are from white people or from the countries that get carved up, that the tribal differences meant that they weren't selling their brothers into slavery. They were selling their enemies into slavery. And so the construction of the divisions of people allow for participation and a delivering of people to another people that it's hard to even imagine from the lens of our present day language. But all of it makes it more complicated, but I think leaves us in a position of power, even as participants, right? I think that we're even more powerful as participants, that we sold ourselves, we contributed to this. That by itself makes the European less untouchable. It makes the European taking advantage of a human nature that allowed us to become traitors to ourselves, where we have self-sabotaged and put ourselves in position that we could take ourselves out of if we saw ourselves as powerful enough to do it. But when we tell the story that we are weak and we victims and that this happened to us, and even stuff around like them stripping our names, like they did, or maybe they attempted to, right? That's certainly a part of the strategy, is to try to dehumanize the people. I think that what they did was dehumanize themselves, and that we maintained our humanity because I'm still Drummond. I still love my culture. Like, despite every attempt that they could have thrown at us, all the torture, all the violence, all the scheming, all the manipulation, it did not stop you from going to the African Fest and buying a cowrie shell necklace and locking your hair. It didn't stop me from having a Yoruba Eleke on, going through initiations into African spiritual systems and writing books about it. It didn't dehumanize us. It didn't strip our names or our drums away. They tried, and it was a part of the strategy, but we won, and as evidenced by this conversation that we're having. So that frame makes me feel more powerful. That frame makes me feel like our ancestors figured some things out. They may have strategized in a moment to use a name, but then they still had their own rituals and ceremonies in the back harbors and the ring shouts, and they hid it underneath the theology of the time. They knew they had to survive so that one day we could be born and exercise and express a fuller version of who we are. But there was a power in what they had to do to maintain whatever they did to make it so that I'm still here, and that there's communities of us that are still here doing this. And we got to tell the story in that way, right? I think that's a different frame and a different perspective that leaves us feeling like we weren't just like losing over and over again, that we won in a different kind of way, despite an attempt of an enemy to try to take everything from us. And then, you know, there's harms, there's damages. We have wounds for sure. There's things that we lost, but we didn't lose everything. And then we can lean on what we kept and look at the ways in which our drums maintained themselves in tap dance, the ways that our spiritual systems found their way through the Pentecostal church. And we can still find ways to see the African still in us, even if we don't call it that, that there's a power in the transmission of culture in that way that leaves us, the person hearing that story, more likely to lean in, to study more. Right now, people are like, I'm tired of slave movies. I don't want to hear nothing about slavery no more. And that's not because slavery wasn't, right? It was a terrible institution. But if we can look at that institution and find the ways that we fought every time, that every step of the way, that there were those of us that were like, nah, we ain't doing this, I ain't going, and tell those stories, then people were like, oh, I would love to see a slave movie if the slave movie is about us winning, or at least fighting. Yeah. But if the slave movie is just getting lynched and saying, yes, sir, master, no, sir, master, and having a head down and humming and singing, if like nobody want to see that. Because that part, that's not even the truth of what was happening in totality. That's a part of it, but there are other parts of it, right? And then we had traitors, we had people that, you know what I'm saying, were Black overseers. All those are complicated parts of the story, but the larger story is of here we are, and yet here we are.
And of course, we also had African-American folks in this country who owned slaves. So that's another part of the complicated story. So let's go ahead and take a break right here, and then we come back. We will pick up because I think the way you frame this about that it empowers us and our own choice and decision-making as being part of the process is something that I really love. So let's take a break and then we'll be right back.
Okay.
Heaven abounds in you, enlightens, uplifts, inspires, and invites you to live a life that's engaged, joyous, and limitless, the sweet spot of life. Take this journey in oneness. We are and have all that God, the infinite creative source of the universe, is. You are infinite potentiality, and the kingdom of heaven is within you. Heaven abounds in you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Balan A. Durr, and joining me today on Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot is my guest, Dr. Obari Cartmett. And before the break, we were talking about how reframing our story enables us to assume our power in our experiences, and then also again to I would say take responsibility for our participation in creating our experiences, that we're not just a victim, and then how, of course, that empowers us not only to reframe the story or the narrative, but also at the end empowers us to do some things differently. And you know, one of the things that I would say, and you actually brought this up, was that how many people actually do know about the fact that, again, when white Europeans came to Africa, you know, they didn't just walk up into the interiors of the continent. They didn't just grab people on their own, right? What they did was, as you pointed out, it also, to me, speaks to, again, what you hear even now about African people. I mean, African people, they're not a monolith, just like African-American people are not a monolith. The fact that they considered themselves as separate and different. And one of the things I remember watching the movie, The Woman King in the Kingdom of Dahomey, obviously there's this conversation between the king and between the general, with her saying to him, you know, that we at one point are saying to him, we weaken ourselves by selling off our people, right? Yeah. There is, you know, at some point when you mentioned, and that's how they thought of it. This was, you know, folks that we gained in the process of, as you know, the spoils of war. They're our enemy. So again, it's seen as separate and different. You the other. Right. You the enemy. You not me. You not mine. And so again, how do I benefit? But again, it's also a different, it's also a different system of slavery. So I think, again, to your point, there is the benefit of, again, saying, I'm not completely a victim here. Right. And because I'm not completely a victim here, what was my, and I say my in terms of our role in what happened to us, not from a place of blame. And I don't want people to mishear that or misunderstand it. It's not from a place of blame, but from an instance, as you said, you have all these different dynamics and how people think of themselves, right? How do I think of myself? Again, this is me and my family and my society, my culture, my kingdom over here, and you're not a part of that. And so we're, we're competing for resources. And in the competition for resources, we do these kinds of things to each other, which unbeknownst to us, we didn't realize how harmful it was to us as Black people of, you know, Africans on the continent, and how harmful that was and what it ended up doing. But I think, again, to your point, to reclaim going, you know, now I'm not powerless. For me, I I tend to think of power, I think it's similar to how you think of it, but for me, power is you can have control over my body, but you can never have control over my mind, over what I think, over how I feel. And therefore, in that, my power comes in my ability to choose for myself, right? That I get to choose. And in choosing, I create my results. I create my experience. And so, again, do I choose, given whatever my circumstances is, my situation is, do I choose to demonstrate my sacred self and my infinite potential that I am as a child of the Creator, made of stardust here on the planet at this time? Irrespective of what anybody else, how anybody else conceptualizes me and my identity and abilities.
Right. And so if someone else could hear that and say, no, I disagree. You 3/5 of a human. You ain't stardust. You ain't infinite potential. You a dog. Them thinking that should not have the impact, the power over your controlling. We should have been able to flick them away like a flea. Like somebody walk up to me right now and say, you ain't nothing. You just a and you ain't. I wouldn't hurt my feelings. It would not impact me in any way.
Right.
I would so quickly dismiss that because I would think of that person as crazy. I would think that that person is deranged. That person or just not even worth evaluating who or why that person is. I would just keep moving about my day. But the power becomes they think that and then they create infrastructure to operationalize that. And then the question is still always like, how were they able to do that? And if we don't really answer that question, like if we can talk Africa was great and mighty and the kings and queens and all of that, but if we don't have a good explanation for our young people about how Africa fell so hard, then it does a disservice to the stories they were telling. Like if we so great, then why are we losing still? Why are we losing still? And I think the answer to that has to be part of the ways in which, you know, human nature, if you tell the story of the kings and queens in Africa that decided to participate in the trade, that they at some point got greedy. We're talking generations of somebody, you know what I'm saying, feeding their pockets and their family benefiting from it at the expense of other families, which isn't that much different as a philosophy than what I think a drug dealer in a hood would do.
It's no different than capitalism. It's no different than capitalism.
So
you know what, before, because I think that you're making some wonderful points, insightful points. And so before you finish that, I just wanted to actually share a story of my own that was in keeping with what you were talking about, which was many years ago, at this point is over 20 years ago, I was the director of the inpatient unit, the acute child and adolescent unit at a facility. And one day, this little white boy who was somewhere 18 years old, something like that, and he called me the N-word. And so I checked myself to say, how do I feel about this? And I realized I felt nothing. And the wonderful thing about that was that I felt nothing. And I said, you know, this little one right here, somebody taught him this hatred. But number one, I'm not losing my high paying job and your fear, right? The other thing too that I thought to myself was, I looked at him and I said, your perception of me does not define my identity. And so, of course, he gave me this little quizzical look, and I knew he didn't understand what I was saying, which was okay. Maybe he'll get it later. But the point was that, of course, you don't get to define who I am and my possibilities, because I know what that word means. And because I know what that word means and I know that that's not who I am, I really don't feel any kind of way about you calling me that, because that's not who I am. And that's why I didn't, that's why I didn't feel, I felt just neutral about him calling me that, because I'm like, I know what that word means. That's not who I am. And mm-hmm. And also the other thing I just wanted to comment on too, was that obviously you make an excellent point. In order for me to dehumanize you, I must lose my humanity in the mm-hmm. process. So right. I then end up becoming the very thing that you say I am mm-hmm. in order to treat you that way. Right. So the loss is not the loss obviously is I may suffer some losses in how I'm treated, how I'm harmed. I don't lose my humanity in the process, but you lose yours in the process.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Right?
So,
to do what they had to do, they had to align themselves with some really dark spiritual forces. They had to submit to demons. They had to succumb in a way that made them more like that demon. The
dark side.
Right. Than mm-hmm. the humans. For us to be able to endure their demonic ways and still love each other and still get married and to still raise babies, knowing that we've given our babies, like that's the epitome of what a human is. Mm-hmm. And so we have to find that frame and realize what power we came from. And then from that, I think that as a platform allows us to really just soar in ways that the other frame, the lost, the dehumanized, the three-fifths, like if we keep telling the version of the story that they gave to us, mm-hmm. that reinforces their power. I think they love that story. There's a Lynching Museum that won awards for being the best museum a year or two ago down in somewhere down south. I would never take my kids to a lynching
museum. The one in Alabama?
In Alabama. Never take my kids. I would never take my kids to a lynching museum. I don't want to. That's not the part of the story that I want to capsulize and repeat over and over again. And I know why we do it. That's why it's complicated. I know, particularly for like the young people who are disconnected, and the further away we get, the more young people lose the gratitude. I was just watching Queen of Katwe with my boys 2 days ago. He playing mm-hmm. chess. And I wanted mm-hmm. him to see like what sacrifice is. Like, because they be complaining about going to school all the time and having to read. And I try to tell them stories of children around the world that are begging to go to school and would love to switch places with you. But yes. I wanted them to see that movie. I wanted them to watch that film to show like you and your chess club after school and you having fun and you doing what you feel like. You got to do tablets. But there's somebody that carved the pieces out of wood and still mastered this game despite the circumstances, and their circumstances are much more dire than yours. So we had that conversation watching the movie. They got to sort of see a depiction of it, like, oh man, they didn't have that image in their brain. And so mm-hmm. I think it's important that as we got young people who have forgotten where we've come from, that this mm-hmm. isn't the right side of the mountain for Black people in this country, mm-hmm. that there's an intention to want to, almost like 9/11, like never forget. We don't want people to never forget what our ancestors sacrificed. And so from that intention, we tell the lynching stories and we talk about the brutality and we show the images of like the African people getting brutalized and tortured. And that's what happens in the film. They're almost like really passionate about the ugliness and the brutality. And like, you know, I'm very careful not to put those images in my brain. I saw Nat Turner. I went to Nat Turner for inspiration. I wanted to feel good. And they, mm-hmm. you know, they spent a little bit of time of him fighting back, but they ended the film with mass lynchings. They really dug into the loss. They really wanted us to almost, it was almost like a cautionary tale. Like, mm-hmm. you can do it, but we're going to get you, right? And I think that those kinds of, the same thing happened in the Will Smith film, Emancipation. Most of the films about slavery, I think, are much more attentive to the struggle and to the brutality and to the torture. And I think that in the mind of the filmmakers, at least some of the Black ones, is don't forget what we've been through. I think that's important, but I don't know, I don't need to see the gory details of it. But I also think that there is some maybe unspoken intention behind the white filmmakers to be like, let's show them what we did to them, right? And they might not even articulate it in that way, but I think that it comes off in that way. I think it comes off like just in the same message that we always got, which is to be obedient, like be quiet. Like I'll show you some rebellion, but I'll show you even more what happens to those who decided to do that. We need stories of victory and through and through. And even if there's a loss, because there were lots of losses, that part of the story, I think that we should deliberately highlight and then diminish the parts of the story that are about struggle so that young people are really like into it. So they can really want to go back and learn more and study more and learn from the lessons and be inspired by the successes. But I don't think we're doing it. I don't think that we're doing it in that way.
Well, I think, and obviously to your point, I think part of what's communicated in those stories too is also as our resilience. You know, as I like to say, we are still here, right? Mm-hmm. So despite all of that, you know, we are resilient, and despite all that they've done to us, we're still here. And right. And while we may not be thriving maximally, there's still a sense that we are thriving as a people, that our influence on culture and people and how they live lives is ubiquitous, right?
Yeah.
You find it's global. So despite what they've attempted to do, you know, we still, in our own ways, our culture flourishes, you know, to your point.
So that's it. So I think it's the same message.
I want to do this because I want to make sure that we don't lose sight of this, which is you started to talk about this, which is, so what things do we do in order to change the narrative, in order so that it's uplifting and empowering, and so that it fuels our mental health. What things we can do.
So that is an important message. Despite what happened, we still here is an important message, and I think we need to have that as a part of it. I just feel like at the exact same time, it's the same coin flipped on its head, that because of what we did to fight, we are still here. And it's the same event, same time period, same story, but something about focusing on what we did, how we came over, what we leaned on, what cultural, what spiritual, what community practices we had. Focusing on that part of the struggle, I think gives us more insight into what we can do now that allows us to move forward, building on the not even just the sacrifice. I almost said building on the sacrifices. I think that's what, you know what I'm saying? I'm so used to that language. To build, to pay the debt out of the duty for the sorrow that they experienced is one way of thinking about it. At the exact same time, it's just the same story flipped on its head, that to build on the strengths and to look at the story, to try to find and pinpoint the power, that becomes the blueprint for what I can use to inspire myself, to grow on, to add to continue to move forward on top of strength and not on top of sorrow. I just think it's the same story. It's just like, it's just the difference in the frame, I think, leaves us with more skills, with more inspiration. Because the sorrow is like, we still survive. I think that keeps us in survival mode. We survive despite, and we can keep on trudging along and being grateful that we're here. I think it's a different story than like, man, look what we did. And look who we are. That's still in you. Let's add to that. Let's connect to that. And then let's have that flourish in ways that I think could move further.
Right. So I think, one, we just need to throw off other people's characterization of who we are and what we did and in terms of and what we're able to accomplish.
Yeah.
I think it begins there. And then I think also, again, you're saying is, again, that how we share the narrative of the story needs to move to one of power and responsibility, as opposed to victim and blame. again, not taking away from or diminishing any.
It may be even the difference between resilience and resistance. Same stories. One says you tough enough to make it, and that leaves you thinking, I might just keep enduring what they're giving to me now because I'm tough enough to hold on. But resistance to what's happening gives me another angle to see this. If I can see the old from a different angle, then I'm able to see the present and the future from that same angle. And I think that moves us past survival, past just hoping the next generation has another opportunity.
Right. But to your point, there's a beauty in our resistance, right? I remember that line actually from a favorite movie of mine. There's a beauty to our resistance. And in order for us to be here in the way we are, that required resistance, resistance to succumb to your characterization of me and to keep me as a commodity that's for your profit, power, and pleasure. There's resistance inherent in that struggle, right? To be free, to be a human being, despite somebody else's characterization that I'm not. So I think that the other thing too, that you were kind of talking about, alluding to, is I think part of the difficulty though, in terms of why the story gets shared is in order, because there's a tendency, as you well know, in this country, I did it on my own, right? The individual. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is nobody gets through this life on their own with no help and no support from anybody else. And so when you disconnect, especially in this country, when you disconnect from your identity as part of this community, there is tremendous loss. And I remember in watching some things where some programs where people or movies where people were trying to pass. It wasn't until I watched those movies I realized how much they did sacrifice. And the sacrifice for some people was so, because I wasn't really thinking about it until I saw the movies. Well, basically you had to cut off anything and everybody from your past, your family, friends, everybody, because you didn't want people to find out that you were of African descent. So that is a tremendous sacrifice, both in terms of your psyche, and even for some people to their mental health, to the point where some people, committed suicide. Mm-hmm. So again, to bring this this back to then, again, what things that you think we do that are going to help our mental health?
Yeah. I'm going to give another example. This is new for me. Kind of blew my mind a little bit. So I want to share how my mind was blown the other day.
I was going
to
say, that's saying something. You got a blown mind. No,
it was really wild, right? I went to a lecture almost a week ago. It was about the stories of the freedom seekers that came from the South, a lot in Missouri, Tennessee, that came, some Alabama, Georgia, but they came through Illinois. Someone has documented their trek that landed in a lot in the South suburbs, some in what is now Chicago. And it was kind of just telling those stories of our ancestors who made that trek and connected with the abolitionists and talked about the safe houses and the Underground Railroad and that presence here in this part of the state. He said, there's no document evidence that the way we tell the story of the Underground Railroad trek had anything to do with the spirituals or the quilts. So I started digging. I didn't take this old white man word for it, but I started digging. I started looking to see if anybody has spoken about debunking the myth of the quilts. And I found lots of stuff. People have written extensively on this idea that's a mythology that people are telling and making lots of money on and making new replicas of quilts, but doesn't really, it's not really actually true. Okay. So I say that to say,
because well, in this last minute, like I said, I want
to. Oh, yeah, time. Okay, right. I say this to say it's a really complicated ask to talk about this complex history, but the frame that I think is relevant, even with the Underground Railroad quilts, is that. And this is what I asked him. Does the quilt version of the story do a disservice to what our ancestors really had to go through? Is it an oversimplification? Like, is part of the power in the story is to really look at what they actually had to do and not the simple sort of storytelling versions of it, to really honor the sacrifice, to really look at the depth of the brilliance and the camaraderie and the risk that they took. And that's a much more complex story than I think that we're comfortable with and are used to. And I like to dig into those nuances was the word you said, because I think in the nuance is power. I think in the nuance is sophistication. And I want to give our ancestors their due diligence for what they really had to endure and what they were really up against. And if that means giving the quilts away, if that means taking away my emotional connection to that story, then I think that's a part of what our Black history's acknowledgments should be doing. So thank you for indulging in that, though.
You're welcome. So I know you actually have some programs coming up here real quickly, especially in this month, because, you know, you moving all around, like I said, around the country to help uplift and empower us. So, you know, just, you know, share some of those with us for this coming month.
It's easy to find me on the Instagrams, Facebooks, put my name in, Obari Cartman, and I post all the flyers there. There's a couple things coming up. Just really cool stuff happening. Or if you find me at my website, I have a list of flyers that I'm going to send out probably tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's stuff going on that I'm doing, that other people are doing, some really cool stuff happening. So. If you're interested, please tune in. Come find us.
So, you know, again, thank you so very much for sharing your brilliance and your insights, your nuanced insights and understanding. So thank you so much, you know, for that. I appreciate you greatly. And of course, I'm sure, you know, have you back on the program again. Soon.
I'll be back.
Thank you. I hope you have heard some things that uplift, empower you, and have expanded your awareness and understanding of telling a powerful story that fuels your potential, your possibilities, and your mental health. And I'm your host, Dr. Balan A. Durr. Awakening and empowering you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in a sweet spot. I'll see you next week. Thank you for joining us today in the sweet spot. Share, follow, and like us on social media. To learn more, please visit BalanADurrMD.com, spelled BalanADurrMD.com. Join us next week, and remember, when you heal your mind, all things are possible.